Yes, I am he, yet again, returning this time for what is essentially a one-hour delayed beginning of a program of Talkback, but it also morphs into a Behind the News. It's a hybrid presentation here this afternoon. I am Hugh Hamilton, and with me in studio this afternoon, I am very pleased to welcome Mr. Doug Henwood, about whom more will be said in a moment. Mr. Michael G. Haskins is our audio engineer. This is day two of our fall membership and fundraising drive, as you have been hearing all day, and we would like you during the next 2 hours to indicate your support of this radio station, WBAI, by giving us a call at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And to become a member of WBAI at whatever level you can afford, $50 is our basic membership, $25 if you're a senior citizen or on fixed income. And I am very pleased to debut this afternoon, a brand new book by Doug Henwood. It is titled After the New Economy. Thank you very much for that call. Doug Henwood is, of course, the renowned editor of the Left Business Observer. He is author of Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom, and, of course, the host of a weekly radio program heard here at WBAI on Thursday afternoons from 5 o'clock, Behind the News. Doug Henwood is an internationally respected economist and business analyst, and his new book, After the New Economy, is published by the New Press. He has been very generous with his time this afternoon, agreeing to come in from 4 o'clock instead of his usual 5 o'clock. We'll talk about the book and about some of the issues that he covers in this book. In addition to the book, by the way, he has also prepared a special audio commentary, a companion audio commentary that comes along with the book, and we'll make them both available to you with your pledge at the $100 level. Thank you very much for this call. Now, because we only have 2 hours, we have to be out of here by 5 minutes before 6 o'clock this afternoon. What I'd like you to do is to keep the phones ringing while we have a conversation going. I know that for some, it might be a little distracting listening to the conversation and at the same time dialing the telephone, but I'm sure that you can figure it out. We need to hear from you in very large numbers this afternoon. The $100 level offering for this book is a deal. I have read this book. As I've said before, I never recommend or present anything I have not myself read and approved of. Now, I, of course, am nowhere qualified or credentialed to pass judgment on a work like this. However, I can tell you something, which is that even I get it. Even I understand it. And if I can understand it, anyone can. That is the level of expertise that Doug Henwood brings to this book and to his writing. He makes it possible for us to understand what otherwise might be arcane or esoteric language, graphs, and there is language in here, there are graphs in here, there are statistics in here. It's got everything that you would need, but he also deconstructs all of this so that it can be communicated to anyone with any reasonable degree of intelligence. One can understand what happens after the new economy. And Doug Henwood is in studio with us this afternoon. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Henwood.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you are very welcome, sir.
I feel like I'm just poaching on your real estate.
Not at all. 212-209-2950 is the telephone number. Please keep the phones going while we're talking. 212-209-2950 at the $100 level. You will have this brand new book, After the New Economy, in addition to a companion commentary on Compact Disc by the author, Doug Henwood. I love this introduction. For a while in the late 1990s, you're right, Doug, we had a new economy. It was the wonder of the world. Computers had unleashed a productivity miracle. Recessions were things of the past. Ideas had replaced things as the motors of economic life. The world had become unprecedentedly globalized. Work had become deeply meaningful, and mutual funds had put an end to class conflict. Even to conventional minds, a lot of that sounds embarrassing now, but commentary on the era usually treats it as a mix of collective folly and outright criminality, never as something emerging from the innards of the American economic machinery. I love that. It sets a great tone for the rest of the book. What was or is this new economy? Fact or fiction?
Oh, well, I guess you could say there's always a new economy, at least since the beginning of capitalism 700 or 800 years ago. It's a relentlessly innovative system. But what was new about this era? Well, we've had many new economies, so I think that we've had at least four in the last 100 or so years. And they often have very similar language about them, very similar fantasies about them. It's these are periods of, well, we hit some of the highlights here, some kind of technological revolution or organizational revolution. At the turn of the last century, there was the emergence of the large corporation from small-scale capitalism to this big business with professional managers. This was going to solve many, many problems among them, you know, the end of the business cycle, permanent prosperity, end the class conflict. It'd be reasonable, rational, efficient, and all these wonderful things. At the end of the 1920s, we had another one. It was a technological revolution. It was the automobile and radio. And again, same story. End of class conflict. Everybody's a big, happy family. Mm-hmm. No more recessions, you know. End of the 1960s, very similar thing. And again, at the end of the 1990s. So it seems to come at the end of decades, mm-hmm. At the end of long periods of prosperity, and at least the first three examples were followed by periods of rather serious economic distress, and it could be that we're in the midst of one of those now. But they do have this sort of fantasy of being released from the physical and social limits of the material world and capitalist social relations. We're in this world of permanent prosperity, end of, you know, peace, love, and understanding, and then it all comes on badly undone, and you know, we end up with depression or war or God knows what we're in the midst of right now.
But you say that the thing about this discussion about this new economy was that nobody was ever discussing it as something emerging from the innards of the American economic machinery. What does that mean?
Well, for one thing, this has long been, the U.S. Economic model has long been one of pretty weak welfare state, weak social protections, weak unions, an eagerness to write workers out of the picture. You know, things just happen because of the brilliance of inventors and engineers and managers, but actual workers sort of disappear. The U.S. has long had a very big role for the financial system compared to other countries. Stock market has been very much more important, much more so than in other economies. And there's this but this was a really hopped-up moment of that. Everything was really just like it was that usual stuff on steroids, mm-hmm. or on speed or some kind of drug, and it was kind of fun while it lasted. It had a utopian quality, an exuberant quality that I don't want to lose touch with, and I talk about this in the book and also in this mm-hmm. little talk that we'll hear later, and which people will get for their $100 pledge by calling 209-2950 in the 212 area code mm-hmm. for their $100 pledge to that important number, 212-209-2950. Yeah, it was this very exuberant variation on that, and I think almost akin to some kind of manic disorder. If you read a psychiatric description of mania, it's mm-hmm. very similar to a lot of what happened in the late 90s.
You know, something that leapt out at me was when you said that technology and globalization should be neutral terms. Whether they're good or bad depends on how they're used. We hear a lot about technology and its capacity for revolutionizing our way of life and the way we work and whether we work. And you also refer, of course, to the fantasy that maybe we have actually approached the end of work, and about which others have written. And we also hear quite a great deal about globalization, that it has come to have this very negative connotation. But you say both technology and globalization are supposed to be neutral terms. It's a question of how they're used. Expand on that.
Well, for one, technology, I mean, from my point of view, my own life, computers have been very, very good things. It's enabled me to, I produced this book, I laid it out, I indexed it, you know, all the graphics in it. I send a disk to the publisher, and I produce a newsletter in similar ways. I can get all kinds of data and information through the internet. About half the references in the bibliography were downloaded electronically. So from my point of view, it's a wonderful thing. I've gotten to know people around the world, made contacts with people around the world, developed real friendships because of electronic connections. So it's really enriched my social and work life. That's not true for everyone. For a lot of people, computers are things that they're stuck in their cubicle and in really boring labor under very intense supervision. Computers allow people to be monitored and supervised much more effectively than they were in the past. For a lot of people, it means the degradation of work, the de-skilling. As all the skill gets put into the machine, the job itself becomes duller and dumber. There's an immense variation in the way technology can be used and the way it's experienced. Also with globalization, like I said earlier, this technology has allowed me to make friends and contacts around the world, and that's a good thing. I think we've seen this, what people I think erroneously call the anti-globalization movement, which is in fact a global movement for social justice. I think contact among peoples of all kinds is a wonderful idea. I don't think that there's anything desirable really about a realm of a world in which we were had regional or national or local self-sufficiency. I have all kinds of commerce and intercourse with other people. But what we come to think of as globalization really is intensification of capitalism, intensification of competition, and intensification of sort of individual war of each against all, and that's a bad thing. I think it often is used as a very inaccurate substitute for imperialism. When the IMF goes in and remakes the whole national economy, telling people what to do, that's a bad kind of globalization. I think a good kind of globalization is when workers across borders make common cause with each other against their boss, or when members of this international global justice or peace movement make contact with each other. That's a good kind of globalization. So there's some people within that movement really are longing for a return to the local or the national, and I don't really have much nostalgia for that. I really like the world as our entire scope of operations. The two of us all come from very different parts of the world, and it's very nice we're sitting across from each other, I think, and so many of the listeners come up from all over the place. People can listen to this show on the internet from halfway around the world if they want to. These are good things, and I think we should separate the competitive and imperialist and oppressive aspects of globalization from those positive ones. So the words technology and globalization are sometimes thrown around like cuss words, I think they also have immense capacity for liberation in them.
You have an entire chapter here on work, and I'd like to get to that in a moment. But before we do that, I need to remind you that it is 19 minutes after 4 o'clock, and our guest this afternoon is my colleague, Doug Henwood, who is the editor of the Left Business Observer. He is also author of Wall Street, How It Works, and For Whom. And, of course, he is the host of the Behind the News program heard here on Thursday afternoons from 5 o'clock. This is the second day of our fall membership and fundraising drive. Mr. Henwood, who is a noted economist and business analyst, has written a brand new book that he's making available to us as a premium, as our way of saying thank you to you with your pledge at the $100 level. He's in studio. We're having a conversation, but while this conversation is going on, we would also like to encourage you to call in and become a member of WBAI at whatever level you can afford. And if you can afford to pledge at the $100 level, which I strongly encourage you to do, you will get your very own copy of this book, After the New Economy by Doug Henwood, and together, by the way, together with a companion commentary, a portion of which we would like to be able to play for you this afternoon. It all depends on several variables, including how well the phones are ringing, how often the phones are ringing, how well you are responding. So I urge you to do so. Go to your telephones, please, and give us a call at 212-209-2950. and become a member, and at the $100 level, we'll send you this new book, After the New Economy, by Doug Henwood, together with a companion commentary on compact disc. You did, Doug, an entire chapter on work, in which you note that while average incomes have risen considerably over the last half century, the amount of work necessary to earn those incomes has risen with equal relentlessness. And you go on to discuss the way we approach work, how much we work, and in relation not only to previous decades, but in relation to the rest of the world. Talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, with there was a lot of talk about a productivity revolution in the late 90s, which was supposed to be an almost unprecedented its miraculousness. But leaving that aside, there's no question that the last century or two has seen an enormous increase in the productivity of labor. That is, we can produce a lot more per hour of work than we could a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, relentlessly increasing. You would think that in a civilized society, we might take some of the benefits of that in the form of leisure, that if we can produce so much more in an hour, why not work fewer hours in the day? But that's not the way things have worked out. In the United States, in particular, it's true about some other parts of the world, but the United States is really pretty close to the top of the heap on this. We have extremely long work days, work weeks, work years, very short vacations. The number of hours the average worker puts in a year in the United States is much higher than just about any other country in the world, except South Korea, I think. Japan used to be up there, but since they had their recession, they're not working as hard.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 2 week vacations here. A lot of people don't take their vacation. In Europe, they have 4 or 5 week vacations. In Australia, they have 4 or 5 week vacations mandated by law in a lot of countries. I think this is a society that, a lot of critical economic rhetoric over the years has been about unemployment, and God knows that's certainly a problem. Mm-hmm. We do have mass unemployment and people who are sort of permanently outside the labor market, but there is also, for people who are in it, we're working harder and longer than we ever have before. A larger percentage of the adult population in the United States works than, it came off a little bit in the last couple of years during the recession, but we're very, very close to record highs on that. And there are very few other places in the world where as many people work as they do here. So we have more people working longer hours with fewer breaks and fewer vacations. And it's kind of sick. I think it's very bad for social life. It's very bad for political life. It's very bad for personal and family life to be working that hard. It's just it comes to dominate what people are all about. The question is, we're identified by our occupation, not anything else, not by our temperament or our social ties or anything else. It's just what you are, what you do, in a lot of minds.
But why is that? Why is it that that we work so much longer, so many more hours, and more of us are doing so? And what are the consequences for the economy as translated into our quality of life, our standard of living relative to the rest of the world?
Well, a couple of things. I think, first of all, since we work so long and so hard, we don't necessarily put out as much or can't produce as much in an hour because we're kind of tired and stressed out. So actually, in a lot of other countries, the amount that a worker produces in an hour or a year is actually higher than it is in the United States. They just work less, and they have lower incomes to show for it. So we have, because so many of us work so long, that does produce, big GDP figures and things like that. But it also produces a lot of alienation and exhaustion and stress, I think, along with it. We have a population. You walk into a bookstore anywhere in the United States, and you'll see shelves after shelves of self-help books. People have recovery books, relationship advice books. So I think there is this kind of unacknowledged psychosocial crisis going on, which I think this overwork contributes a lot to, but we don't really talk about it like that. People always individualize their problems. If you have a bad relationship, it's not because the society is sick with overwork. It's because there's something wrong with you. If you Read the right book, maybe you can fix it. But there's almost no conversation in this country about that kind of overwork and the consequences of it for social life. Also, the dumbing down of the culture, I think, depends a lot on this overwork, and the erosion of any kind of public life or political life. Also, people just don't have the time or the energy for figuring out what's going on or getting involved in doing something about it. So we just sort of sit back and watch it all as a spectacle. And the California recall being the most recent instance of that, I think.
Okay, we're talking with Doug Henwood. Our telephone number is 212-209-2950. We need to hear from you while we're having this conversation. I hate to butt into the conversation and to the very eloquent flow of Mr. Henwood's expertise here, but we are in the second day of our membership drive. Thank you very much for that call. I'd really love to hear these phones ringing a great deal more. We're offering you at the $100 level Doug Henwood's brand new book, which has been very glowingly reviewed by a number of experts in the field. We'll get to some of that a little later on. I highly recommend it. It's 26 minutes after 4 o'clock. It's 212-209-2950. That's our telephone number, the name of the book, After the New Economy. And you will get, in addition to the book, a companion commentary on compact disc that Mr. Henwood has prepared exclusively for WBAI and for this offer. So in addition to what you're hearing now, in addition to the insights you're getting now, you will hear the uninterrupted commentary of Doug Henwood on matters economic and business. So you can go to your telephones now and give us a call at 212-209-2950. I urge you to do that. This is something that you need to have. And if you've got students in college, then this is a great gift for them. In fact, it is a great gift for you as well. Well, even if you never thought that you had an interest in economics and business, because Doug Henwood in this book deconstructs so much of what you you skip in the pages of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and any of the other business publications, because it's all so arcane, he makes it make sense. And as I said to you before, if it can make sense to me, believe me, it can make sense to anyone. 212-209-2950. There is a sub-section of this chapter on work in which you look at the 30 fastest growing occupations in America as they are projected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics from the year 2000 to 2010. And the findings are almost counterintuitive if you've been listening to news of the so-called techno-revolution, because it would appear that the jobs that are going to be in highest or greatest demand in the future are not the jobs that we might have thought. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, if you listen to the propaganda, especially around 1997, 98, when things were really irrationally exuberant, we're all going to be computer programmers and systems analysts and web designers, and certainly it seemed at times that everyone surrounding you was doing those things. Parts of New York in the late 1990s were full of people who had just like gotten out of college with a degree in semiotics, who had a job at Razorfish with big options, you know. And if you asked them what they did, you couldn't understand their explanation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very funny bit in Andrew Ross's new book, actually, No Collar, about his time he spent at Razorfish, which was one of these sort of web design marketing corporate image production things that exploded and then disappeared in the last couple of years. But he quotes what the founder of Razorfish described what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make any sense. So actually, he's quoting an interview on 60 Minutes. And the guy asked him again, what do you do? What do you do? And the guy gave a second equally incomprehensible explanation. He said, no, uh-huh. What do you really do? And it was a third incomprehensible explanation. Then he finally gave up. But, you know, there was that moment where it seemed like everybody's doing something very lucrative but completely incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at what the kinds of jobs that have been growing and what the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects will grow into the next decade, there are some things like that. Systems analysts are on there, senior managers are on there, things like that. But it's also home health aides, cashiers, truck drivers, registered nurses, some of which are pretty good jobs,
mm-hmm.
but they're certainly not this high-tech fantasy that most people think. A lot of them are of the kinds of jobs that have been around for a very long time. And it's certainly got nothing to do with the high-tech dreams that you would read in Wired magazine or the kinds of things that people in the Clinton administration used to talk about during the happier days of the 90s. A lot of rather old-fashioned, some of them very mundane, and a lot of them very low-paying occupations. Surprisingly, quite a few of them don't require an awful lot of education or training. You know, we hear all the time the way to get ahead in society is, you know, you have to be properly educated, properly trained, or else you're going to be left behind. But an awful lot of these jobs require no more than a high school education and a short on-the-job training. Now, certainly not demeaning people with mm-hmm. those kinds of skills, but this is not what the propagandists of our bright techno future have been saying.
How could they have been so far wrong, though?
I think a couple of things. I think the people who make these kinds of projections live very isolated lives, and they're surrounded by people very much like themselves. You saw that with, I think, a bunch of academics, journalists, pundits, people like that, who really... They have their houses cleaned for them. You know, much of the things they do in life the details of the life are taken care of by other people. So, you know, they can sort of forget about all the things that all these other people are doing. So they think that everyone else is doing the same things they are. They think that everyone else is discounting cash flows with Microsoft Excel when actually far more people are driving trucks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also a chapter here on income, and you discuss, among other aspects of income disparity and distribution, the questions of race and sex. You note that it's important to look at how race and sex figure. You note that since 1993, even the poorest fifth of black households have enjoyed stronger income gains than whites. The gap remains huge, with average black incomes just 64% of non-Hispanic whites in 2001, but there's no denying progress has been made over the decade. And you note also that news of the gender gap is even more dramatic. In a moment, I'd like to ask you to discuss what your findings were, and these are accompanied by very fine graphs and statistics and so on, but I just read the part that's in prose. That's the part I can understand, which is great. It's 33 minutes after the hour, and we're talking with Doug Henwood, whose new book, After the New Economy, is available to you together with a companion commentary by Doug Henwood himself with your pledge of $100 to WBAI. I'd like in a moment to share with you a portion of that commentary, but we also would like you to give us a call now at 212-209-2950. What we're doing here is a bit of an experiment. I'm trying to encourage you to call us and to become a member of the station and to support this radio station because of what we do and the unique insights that you get from someone like Doug Henwood, who is also editor of the Left Business Observer. You can call and support us so that we can keep this operation going. At the same time, I would also like to be able to make to get the maximum benefit of Mr. Henwood's expertise while he's here this afternoon until 6 o'clock. But don't wait until 6 o'clock. We need to hear the phones ringing now. So please go to your phones and support the station. If you can afford it at the $100 level, I urge you to do so. Get a copy of this book. It's a great book. The scales will fall from your eyes. It's titled After the New Economy, and it's available to you with a companion audio commentary on compact disc with your pledge of $100. On the matter of race and sex in your chapter on income, why do these matter?
Well, they're very important parts of our lives. American life is race is obviously a very, very important part of American life and has been for quite a little, since the beginning. And of course, you know, relations between men and women are extremely complicated and very important political and social things too. But there's a lot of happy optimists around who think that that sex discrimination on the basis of race and sex has disappeared, or is on, very close to having disappeared. Certainly, the gaps are narrowing. income gaps between particularly black and white workers have been narrowing, in between men and women have been narrowing, but they're still pretty wide, much wider than they should be. And what's interesting is that if you look at things at a really a detailed level, economists have these things called standard wage equations. That is, they assume that your income, your wage, is a function of several things. It's your education, your experience, your age, the profession you work in. And, you know, there's maybe 5 or 10 of those kinds of things that they use to predict wages. But if you compare men and women, or black people and white people, with identical qualifications, you know, if they had all these variables were the same except for their race and their sex, there is persistent discrimination, a gap of 10 to 15% as a result, that you can statistically attribute just to discrimination. And that remains very stubbornly large, even despite, you know, a lot of progress over the last decades. There's still this very wide gap, which is a measurable form, statistically provable form of racial and sexual discrimination, and it hasn't gone away.
But, you know, you also discuss here that there is a theory that says that discrimination doesn't make sense in a capitalist economy, because if you are going to pay white people more to do something that non-white people will do for less, and you've got two different companies, one is paying white people more to do the same thing that non-white people are being paid less to do by another company, the company that's paying less is going to make more money. But I think you went on to show that there is an inherent fallacy in that argument.
Well, it's just the persistence of discrimination is there. So this mechanism, which the University of Chicago economist Gary Becker is most famous for having propounded this theory, that under capitalism discrimination is irrational and will be competed away. It's just the fact that it continues to exist is refutation enough. But I think it's clear that that business people, capitalists, don't always behave rationally, that they are also driven by emotion and prejudice and bad feelings, and that sometimes takes precedence over what might seem like the rationality of the spreadsheet.
This is WBAI New York, where it is now 37 minutes after the hour. In a moment, we'll listen to some of the audio commentary. I'll ask Doug Henwood to tell us a bit about the commentary that he has prepared that is a companion to the book After the New Economy. But right now, we need to hear the phones ringing. Doug Henwood, as I said, is in the studio. Good afternoon again, Mr. Henwood.
Thanks for having
a book, a book like this, After the New Economy, on its face, might appear to be a work that would be of in the special interest category, to people who are financial analysts, to people who are students of political economy or international economy. But you have written it in a way that is understandable to regular people like me. Why did you do this particular book?
Well, I got the idea actually during the heat of the new economy, and I thought the whole thing was so preposterous and likely to come to a bad end that I was had the debunking urge. But unfortunately, I don't write quickly enough. too many other things to do, and the new economy was finished before I was. But I thought it was worthwhile taking a look back at that. But also, and this is really a pretext for looking at mostly American economic history, but also a good bit of world economic history, too, for the last 20 or so years. What's been going on with this intensification of capitalist competition, you know, the era of neoliberalism, whatever you want to call it, and to explain what its promises, or to look at what its promises were and what its actual performance has been. You know, there was a time in U.S. history back in the late 19th century when ordinary workers and farmers and citizens studied the arcane aspects of monetary economics and things like that during the populist moment of the late 19th century. It was a period of great popular education and activism, agitation. And now that's pretty much all forgotten, in public discourse, economics and economic policy is treated as rather mysterious stuff, stuff for experts, which ordinary people shouldn't trouble themselves with. And I think that's a very bad thing. The money and material interests determine a lot of how our culture works, how our politics work, how our democracy works. More and more, it looks like we're in the rule by the dollar and not the rule by the people. I just try to do my bit of clarifying what goes on. You know, look, any intellectual pursuit, any discipline like economics or anything, is going to have its jargon and its professional mysteries. But I think those are really jacked up by people who want to keep this important area sort of off limits to the public understanding and public action, and I think that's a nasty trick they're trying to pull. So I think that when you're talking about the basics of how an economy works, I think those are quite easily explainable and understandable. And you know, I think a lot of it is just a matter of explaining who gains and who loses, and trying to demystify all the mystifications. It's certainly one of the most mystified areas of life, of money and money politics, and people very often just have this reflex that it's too complicated for me, I can't understand it, and just sort of turn off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very pleased to see over the last 5 or so years that a lot of these issues have become the targets of mass political action, mass understanding, mass protest. I wouldn't have imagined when I started writing about this stuff in the late 1980s that the IMF would and the World Bank would become major political issues in the United States. Certainly they're major political issues in a good bit of the rest of the world, but in this country, you know, we have been sort of living in isolation from the rest of the world's economy, and now we have very large political movements, demonstrations with scores of thousands of people around these things. So I think there's that's a very satisfying sign of progress. We see a lot of agitation around issues like minimum wage, living wage kinds of issues, sweatshop issues. That was not true 10 years ago. It was barely true 5 years ago. So it's very gratifying to see these become popular issues. So I'm just trying to put in my contribution to that effort of agitation, education, and organization.
We're talking with Doug Henwood, whose new book, After the New Economy, is available to you, together with a companion audio commentary, from which you'll hear an excerpt shortly, available to you with your pledge to WBAI at the $100 level. Our telephone number is 212-209-2950. We urge you to give us a call and become a member of WBAI, renew your membership, get a copy of this book and the companion commentary. This is something that you ought to have. Thank you very much for these calls that are coming in now. Wherever you are in our listening area, you heard Mr. Henwood note earlier that words like globalization and technology are supposed to be neutral terms, and thanks to the magic of technology, we are also heard everywhere in this global village via the internet at WBAI.org. I know that we have many of our listeners who join us via the internet, and we urge you to give us a call, if you will, at 212-209-2950. We've got volunteers who are standing by, Claudia and her team. They'd like to get some work done here. So please call them, become a member, support WBAI, listen to sponsored and commercial-free community radio. We're based here in New York, our signal area. We're heard everywhere in New York, in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Mr. Henwood, when it comes to economic policy and political philosophy, it always strikes me as being a bit of a chicken and egg situation. Is it that economic policy is driven by political philosophy? So, for example, you have an administration like the Bush administration in power, and that in turn influences the performance of the economy? Or is it that economic performance drives political philosophy and public policy? How does that work?
I think it's the old dialectic, mm-hmm. each influencing the other. it's hard to say. It is a chicken egg problem, and I guess it is. They come in endless sequence: one chicken, one egg, followed by another chicken. The Bush administration, it seems to me, doesn't really care very much about economic issues. Their economic policy consists of cutting taxes for rich people, and that's about it. They contrast with the Clinton administration, which is obsessed with economic issues, is very stark. The Bush people really are much more interested in political power, the projection of, and especially the projection of imperial and military power abroad. That's what really gets them excited. They're not really interested in economic policy very much, and it shows. We have an economy that's not in very good shape, and the administration doesn't seem to be doing much to address that. And I don't know how long they can get away with it. If the economy doesn't, especially the job market, doesn't show signs of recovery, I think W himself is going to be unemployed come November of next year. But if, you know, the American economy does have a lot of momentum behind it, there is an advantage to being the top dog on the planet. So it's quite possible that it could recover sort of in spite of the administration's neglect, and maybe W will get reelected, which is a very horrible thing to contemplate, but must be contemplated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in that sense, the performance of the economy can certainly shape politics and who wins elections, who loses elections. Back, if we go back into the 70s when the economy was doing rather poorly, it also shaped, helped give rise to the right wing reaction of the late 70s and early 1980s, especially that coming out of the elite level. The elites at that time were very, very dissatisfied with the performance of the economy, and that's why we saw people like Reagan and Thatcher taking office. They very successfully mobilized popular discontent, but it was popular discontent that was eventually turned into a class war from the top to the bottom. And it's certainly people I don't think were voting for wage cuts and cuts in public spending and public benefits and union busting and all the things that became very familiar in the 1980s, but that's what they got. I think in the Clinton years we consolidated a lot of that. There was certainly no reversal of the fundamental policy changes of the 80s. And now we have this administration that just seems to want to make more war and put people in jail, but that's about the extent of their policy interest.
But then you've got another chapter in your book here on finance, and how does all of that translate into money? There's an entire team of technocrats, people like the Alan Greenspans of the world, who are employed regardless of who's in power. How does that sector of the economy work?
Oh, that gets very complicated. I do talk about this in the canned rap we'll be hearing bits of shortly. But there's a temptation to look at everything that the financial sector does as kind of parasitical or peripheral and not really, you know, just off in its own world, doing its own thing, not really connected to the real world of producing things and going to work and that sort of thing. And certainly there are aspects of detachment to it. It certainly does seem like it's, you know, a casino sometimes, or that it's just a fantasy land in which very well-paid people play incomprehensible games.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also at its fundamental level, finance really is deeply political. It's about ownership and control. People who own stocks actually own the companies that whose stock certificates they hold. People who own government bonds have very substantial influence over the policies of the governments that owe them money. And sometimes they don't really exercise that authority, but sometimes they do. And with the stock market, for example, throughout the 80s and 90s, we saw people on Wall Street who had been dissatisfied with the way the markets were going in the 70s and demanded that corporations shape up. And that they cut their expenses and boost profits, and so we've seen this tremendous outsourcing, downsizing, all the increased insecurity that became familiar over the last 20 years. A lot of the impetus for that came from the financial side of shareholders, who were deeply dissatisfied with the way the economy had been run in the 60s and 70s and wanted things to be run much more in their interests. And most people don't get how this works. Most people can't see it, how it works. And we had the spectacle in the late 90s, actually, of people cheering on the stock market. But even though the fact that the bull market itself of the 80s and 90s was in large part caused by the fact that most people's economic lives have been made more difficult, that the stagnation of their incomes and their increasing insecurity, the sense that even within relatively prosperous times, people were still nervous about the future. That insecurity and stagnation of living standards is what made the stock market so happy, that profits were doing well, the overclass was firmly in control, and the stock market, the bull market, was an expression of that. And it was kind of sad to see all these ordinary middle income people pouring into the stock market and cheering on its upward moves, even though really the bull market itself was caused by their own distress.
We're talking with Doug Henwood. It is now 57 minutes after the hour. At the top of the hour, we'll get to the excerpt from the audio commentary that is being made available to you, an audio commentary, a companion commentary by Doug Henwood. It will go together with the book After the New Economy, and you get them both. With your pledge of $100 to WBAI, we are listener-sponsored, commercial-free. This is a book in which he deconstructs a great deal of what ordinarily might be thought of as the arcane world or the esoteric world of economic policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy, and he shows the relationship between the performance of the economy and how you live your life and how much money you make and how you spend the money that you do and how much of it is available to you for discretionary spending and so forth. He addresses a range of not only economic issues but a range of he shows how economic issues intersect with social and political issues. I would strongly suggest that you get a copy of this book with the pledge of $100. Our telephone number is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Coming up at 5 o'clock, it ordinarily would be time for Doug Henwood to sit in the chair that I would have been sitting in, of course, being here on Thursdays among his numerous other engagements. He's here on Thursdays for Behind the News, which he hosts and in which he presents to you much of this information. You are going to be hearing from him again shortly. But in the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. Thank you very much for that call. We'd love to hear from you. We want to be able to bring you as much of Doug Henwood as possible. But, of course, the amount of time that I have to spend doing this, which is asking you to call, is inversely proportional to the amount of time available for you to hear from Doug Henwood. So I know you'd much prefer to hear from Doug Henwood than to hear from me. And quite frankly, so would I. So our telephone number is 212-209-2950. This is WBAI New York, where it is 5 o'clock. And ordinarily, this would be the beginning of Behind the News with Doug Henwood, who is already here and has been here for the past hour. Mr. Henwood, no doubt your devoted listeners are turning their radios on right now, perhaps on their way through the door from their Wall Street jobs or wherever.
It's a pleasant fantasy.
Yes, and of course you are here talking about your book, which we're offering this afternoon with a pledge of $100. The book is After the New Economy, and you also have prepared a companion commentary. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the commentary is sort of a little promotional talk, really, that goes with the book. Some of the touches on a lot of the themes that the book looks at in more detail, it's only 20, 22 minutes long, so it's not like a 400-page or 300-page book, but it's just skimming across the surface of some of the material that's covered in it. I just finished writing it, and recording it and editing it this afternoon, so it's fresh off the CD burner. And it will be, of course, available to anyone who pledges $100 on a CD, along with that book you've been speaking so kindly about, my book, mm-hmm. After the New Economy. And I should say, thanks to the New Press, the publisher of the book, publisher of many, many fine books, for offering copies to WBAI for these fundraisers. We're very grateful to them. And, you know, the New Press is a non-profit organization. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a very important point to make in a fundraising context.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, in this time when the media get dumber and at the same time dumber and more sensational in a very shallow way and more conservative in many cases, a lot of that is driven because they're profit-maximizing entities. They're driven by ratings and money. And the New Press is not driven by ratings and money, and WBAI is not driven by ratings and money. We exist in this kind of not-for-profit world. But that doesn't mean we don't have bills to pay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we do have bills to pay, and people need to call. Pick up the phone and call 212-209-2950, because without the listener support, this little... it's not a cozy world by any means, but this little protected world we live in, apart from the profit maximization, ratings maximization discipline, you know, that we can't continue to live if people don't pick up the phone and call 212-209-2950. And if they pledge $100, they can get a copy of my book, After the New Economy, along with a CD in which I give a talk on some of these the issues covered in the book. That CD will not be available anywhere else except right in this 2-hour segment here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And the person who made that phone ring did so by calling 212-209-2950, and we need many, many, many more people to do that.
Absolutely. 212-209-2950. In a moment, we go to that audio commentary. Susie Bright says of Doug Henwood's new book, After the New Economy, Doug Henwood, this is quoting Susie Bright, Doug Henwood is a wicked genius who makes you laugh while pointing out the most horrific consequences of capitalism's most titillating hours. And Greg Palast says, after Doug Henwood's scorching appraisal, all that remains of the new economy boosters, of the new economy boosters, is a faint smell of burning plastic. And here's what Michael Hart has to say. A healthy antidote for any irrational exuberance. Clear explanations guide the uninitiated through the intricacies and mystifications of economic theories and statistics. This last comment I can wholeheartedly identify with. Clear explanations guiding the uninitiated, that's me, through what otherwise would have been this usually impenetrable discussion when you hear it somewhere else about economics and monetary policy and so forth. But it is all made very clear here in this book, After the New Economy, available to you with your call to 212-209-2950 along with the audio commentary. Let's have a bit of that audio commentary. Doug, you can introduce it.
Yeah, this is really just a short 22 minutes and 44 seconds of talking about some of the major themes in the book, not in anything like the detail that you'd see in the printed page, because that's not appropriate for a short orally delivered speech, but hope it's a tempting treat, an appetizer that will cause people to pick up the phone and call 212-209-2950 and make that pledge of $100 so they can get the book and a copy of a CD with this I don't want to call it a lecture. Let's call it a talk. It's more informal than a lecture. Just a little background on writing the book and also what the major themes are. There's someone who's calling 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Let's see if we can get another couple of calls before we start playing this. Just see if we can get people to ring that bell a couple more times. This is very pre-new economy sound to that telephone.
Absolutely.
Metal hitting metal. Not a familiar sound. 212-209-2950. Let's hear another couple of rings before we unleash the recorded punditry on the listeners.
I like that. The recorded punditry, 212-209-2950. So please go to your phones now and give us a call.
And, of course, we've been urging people to pledge $100 so they can get the book After the New Economy and this exclusive offer of a CD of a little talk about the book. But, of course, we'll take anything. We'll take $5. We'll take
$20.
A basic membership is $50.
$50 basic membership.
Low-income student is $25. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can give hundreds of dollars. If you come into large amounts of money and you want to pledge $10,000, we'd be happy to take it off your hands. So
very
please,
happy.
But with any amount that you can afford to keep the radio station going, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. And in a world where Fox News misinforms people every day, we need institutions like WBAI and the Pacifica Network more than ever. And this feels like a very, very difficult time. And we always, you know, we're always talking about the negative things, the bad things that are happening in the world, and God knows there's certainly, we could go on at great length about that, but, you know, this is something important to support. This is a very mm-hmm. positive institution. It creates a community of listeners, and it helps nurture alternative politics and a vigorous culture in this city, and it would be a much poorer place without it. And but it doesn't come for free. We've got bills to pay, salaries to pay, landlords to pay, the evil bloodsuckers at Con Ed and Verizon to pay. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And let's hear that phone ring one more time, and then we can listen to a little bit of my fresh musing on the new economy. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And it's rather depressingly silent, almost morgue-like room right now.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, thank you very much.
There
you go.
All right. Now that sounds like a healthy set of rings. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Please pledge $100 and you can get a copy of my book, After the New Economy, courtesy of the New Press, just published and only hitting the stores now. So it's really just warm off the presses. And I should also say it's almost worth it, the price for the cover alone, a very snazzy cover designed by the very talented book designer, Alan Hill. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. So let's listen to a bit of this talk I recorded earlier today about this book, After the New Economy.
I started working on After the New Economy when the thing was alive and kicking, back when the NASDAQ was around 3,000, heading towards 5,000, and the air was thick with irrational exuberance. I finished the first draft at the end of February, with the NASDAQ at 1340, 75% off its high. And now it's appearing with the NASDAQ over 1900, up almost 45% from its low. There are two messages from this. One, further proof of the old Wall Street adage, buy the rumor and sell the news. And two, I must learn to write faster. Because even though my unfinished manuscript was full of warnings of disaster, those hardly count. It's much more satisfying to be a prophet before the fact rather than after, although there's not necessarily much reward in it. Many of our leading new economy promoters, starting with Alan Greenspan, have suffered little or no damage to their reputations. That manic blowhard Jim Cramer has a nightly show on CNBC. Most senior execs of Enron remain unindicted. But we mustn't let envy get the upper hand. Remember the new economy? Remember the new economy? Back in 2000, I made a dispiriting discovery. According to a poll by the mutual fund company Scudder Kemper, over 80% of Americans had never heard nor read of a new economy. Even stock market investors, who were supposedly driving the thing, didn't do much better than non-investors at recognizing it. But in some circles, it was all the rage. The new economy of the late 1990s was one of the wonders of the world. Computers had unleashed a productivity miracle. Recessions were things of the past. Ideas had replaced things as the motors of economic life. The world had become unprecedentedly globalized. Work had become deeply meaningful, and mutual funds had put an end to class conflict. Even to conventional minds, a lot of that sounds pretty embarrassing now. But commentary on the era usually treats it as a mix of collective folly and outright criminality, and never as something emerging from the innards of the American economic machinery. And now we're forgetting about it, our amnesia encouraged by frequent reminders that we're in a state of permanent war. I could fact-check a lot of the claims, and I have. GDP growth in the 1990s was good, but well below 19th century rates, and a little different from the growth rates clocked in the much maligned 1970s. But it's taken as a time of almost unprecedented prosperity. Productivity growth looked strong and has gotten even stronger since the bubble burst, but there are plenty of technical oddities behind those numbers that I'll get to a little later. And regardless of the technicalities, how much better off do we feel for all that productivity revolution? More exhausted and more insecure, I'd guess. I could spin out stats on how income and wealth distribution are the most unequal they've been since the early 1930s. Half the population, even at the peak of the boom, didn't own a share of stock. And of those who did, their average portfolio was actually quite tiny. Wealth remains massively concentrated at the top, and the moment of shareholder democracy did nothing to change that fact. Globalization is hardly a new thing, even if you can define it, which a lot of people, even experts, can't. And the whole phenomenon of new eras is hardly new either. There is something aberrational about the late 1990s for sure, but the new economy moment was just a manic set of variations on some ancient themes all promoted from the highest places. Techno-utopianism is an old theme in American culture. Bill Gates' Fantasies of the Frictionless Economy, a book by that title was spun out, it said, with the assistance of 13 ghostwriters, were the latest incarnation of an old elite desire to put workers and the ugly things that sometimes come with them safely out of sight. We've been hearing about post-industrial society for at least 30 years. If it had come about, would we have to worry about global warming? Dreams of an end to the business cycle often flower at the end of long booms. Long-term investors could take them as reliable stock market sell signals. We had a new era at the turn of the last century, one in the late 1920s, and again in the late 1960s, all periods that were followed by long-term economic stress. It's remarkable how similar the language of all these various new eras has been. The early days of the telegraph were laden with fantasies of universal peace, love, and understanding, very similar to those of some of our more fervent web enthusiasts. And even web metaphors were themselves common during the 1840s at the dawn of the telegraph age. And the language and thinking of the 1960s new era sound curiously like the more recent vintage, sharing both a journalistic source, Business Week, and even a trope of Euro envy. In 1965, Business Week, mostly a sane and intelligent magazine, and the most liberal of all the business organs, I should say, patriotically enthused about that new era as giddily as it did about the recent one. Some quotes from the Business Week of 38 years ago prove my point. Some European central bankers and economists have been watching the U.S. economy with utter amazement, some apprehension, and not a little jealousy. By all their rules, the magazine said, the U.S. economy should have started long ago to show the signs of strain that are the inevitable prelude to a bust. Yet despite an expansion that has carried gross national product up a startling 30% over the past 4.5 years, the economy remains generally free from inflationary pressures and imbalances, and the businessmen who run the show fully expect their trouble-free prosperity to continue. The underlying factor behind this remarkable performance, so baffling to the European traditionalists, has been a sharp rise in productivity. That was 1965, not Donald Rumsfeld from the other day. The magazine went on to cite the splendid acceleration in productivity growth since the 1950s, and to quote a Milwaukee CEO as saying, I see no end to the gain in productivity. Unfortunately, productivity gains topped out just 6 months after those words were published, slid into the early 1970s, recovered a bit, but then lapsed into the much lamented productivity slowdown that would extend into the mid-1990s. Inflation bottomed out at the end of that year, and the great and troublesome inflation of the late 1960s and 1970s was just about upon the land. The next year brought the first post-World War II financial panic, the credit crunch of 1966, and the beginning of the slide in corporate profit rates that lasted into the early 1980s. All right, I'd like to touch now on some of the major themes of the book. Though it's organized around the new economy moment and its aftermath, the real story is what's been happening to the economy since the onset of an intensified capitalism, what many people outside the U.S. call the era of neoliberalism, an onset associated with the names Reagan and Thatcher. First, a look at the world of work, which is where the late 1990s productivity revolution was happening. If we are in the early stages of a techno-revolution, we're certainly not distributing its dividends in the form of a lighter workload. Americans have to work awfully hard just to make ends meet. While average incomes have risen considerably over the last half century, rapidly for the first 25 years after World War II, far more slowly thereafter, the amount of work necessary to earn those incomes has risen with equal relentlessness. A worker paid the average manufacturing wage would have had to work 62 weeks to earn the median family income in 1947. In 1973, it would have taken 74 weeks. In 2001, 81 weeks. So despite the fact that productivity overall was up more than threefold, the average worker would have to toil 6 months longer to make the average family income. And the increase in the work effort has come at a more punishing pace in the 1990s than it did in earlier decades. Of course, it's not just individual workers who are putting in longer hours. An ever larger share of the adult population has entered the paid workforce, mainly women, who aren't getting much relief in their household labors to compensate for their increased presence in factories and offices. International comparisons confirm the picture of the U.S. as a workhouse economy. American workers put in more hours per year than workers in Western Europe. Only workers in East Asia spend more time on the job than Americans. And our workers don't produce as impressively as people seem to think. Workers in the Netherlands, Germany, France, and Italy all produce more in an hour than American workers do. And American workers come in barely ahead of their counterparts in Ireland and Sweden. Nor has the growth in U.S. productivity over the recent past been all that impressive. In a 1999 IMF study of 19 major countries, the U.S. came in dead last in productivity growth between 1973 and 1996. It's only over the latter part of the 1990s that U.S. productivity performance ran ahead of that of its peers, though not by all that much, if you use comparable statistics, as more recent work by Credit Suisse First Boston economist Julian Callow shows. And what about that productivity revolution itself? Here's where we have to get uncomfortably deep in numbers, though I'll keep it mercifully colloquial for the audio version. The full details are in the book. Productivity is a measure of how effectively people are working. It compares outputs with inputs. More output for a constant input means a rise in productivity. The most popular measure, labor productivity, measures how much value can be created in an hour of work. Conceptually, that's simple, but there are lots of devils in the details. First, the input. An hour's labor is an hour's labor, yes. But is a doctor's hour the same as a janitor's? Morally and subjectively, yes, they're the same, but economists don't like such squishy concepts. How about a doc freshly out of medical school compared with one 20 years out? An hour that's the same? But those questions are simple compared to that of measuring output. Tons of steel are a pretty straightforward measure, of course, but most products aren't like steel. What is the output of a lawyer, an investment banker? The economist's answer is that money is the universal metric. The value of a worker's output is denominated in dollars, euros, or pesos, corrected for inflation. But how exactly do you adjust for inflation? The concept is to hold quality constant and just measure price changes. If an 8-ounce candy bar becomes a 6-ounce candy bar with no change in price, you've experienced a pretty steep hidden price increase. But what about computers and related high-tech gadgetry? That's where it gets much harder to say. This year's $2,000 computer is probably twice as fast as last year's. That would suggest that its real value has doubled, which is essentially how the government statisticians compute things. So the real value of the computer has doubled, even though its price tag has remained the same. But is this true? Is the output of today's computer really twice as much as last year's? If you're just typing letters and writing emails, the acceleration hardly matters. But to economists, your computer is twice as valuable as last year's model. Is it really? Who knows? But that sort of logic ripples throughout the statistical machinery. As computers have proliferated, their influence on the output measures has increased as well. And that has a big effect on those numbers. Has all this computing power really contributed all that much to human welfare? They certainly don't do much for the 43 million Americans without health insurance. And there are more problems with the inputs. The statisticians measure only the number of hours workers are paid for. If they toil off the clock, as Walmart employees routinely do, those hours aren't counted. The government doesn't have good measures of how long managers work either. In the computer industry, white-collar workers are assumed to work 35-hour weeks. To anyone in the computer industry, that's just hilarious. Why does this matter? For one, important people, starting with Greenspan, think it does. But over the long term, rising productivity is what makes possible rising living standards. And for most Americans, the late 1990s were pretty good times, but hardly miraculous ones. Incomes rose modestly, but not spectacularly. And although productivity has continued to rise, according to the official stats, in the recent recession and so-called recovery, it certainly doesn't feel too good to most of us.
Yes, that bit of pre-recorded punditry there from the author of the new book, After the New Economy, Doug Henwood, who, of course, is usually heard at this time on Thursdays in the afternoon as host of Behind the News, his weekly radio program here on WBAI. He is, of course, also the editor of the Left Business Observer and author previously of Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom. His new book, After the New Economy, is published by the New Press and is available to you this afternoon together with the complete pre-recorded punditry, the companion talk or commentary, available to you both with your pledge of $100 to WBAI. I strongly encourage you to do so. My name is Hugh Hamilton. Please give us a call. Doug Henwood is in the studio, and we'll hear some more from him in a moment. We're discussing his book. We're discussing also the matters that not only are covered in the book, but also getting the benefit of his insight on a number of related issues as well. It is already 24 minutes after 5 o'clock, and the telephone number to call is 212-209-2950. You can become a member using your MasterCard, your Visa MasterCard, or American Express. You can also discuss with our volunteers if you would like to come up with an alternative method of payment. Thank you very much for that call. Then we can bill you over time. You can send us a personal check, or you can send a money order. We will work with you to come up with a method of payment that is most convenient for you. But right now, we ask you to call at 212-209-2950. $50 is our basic membership, $25 if you're a senior citizen or on fixed income. We also have other things that you we can make available to you, like the brand new WBAI t-shirt at the $65 level, and at the $100 level, I strongly recommend that you take advantage of this very generous offer of the book, After the New Economy, by Doug Henwood, together with the pre-recorded punditry, the companion commentary, a portion of which you just heard. 212-209-2950. Doug Henwood, in a moment I'd like to have you talk to us about globalization, which is actually covered in one of your chapters. You've devoted an entire chapter to globalization, and also the fact that the U.S. economy does not exist in a vacuum. And so I'd like you to address how the U.S. economy is affected by and in turn affects such recent phenomena as, or maybe not so recent, as the European Union, which is still in a process of expansion or growth, and the rise of the euro. And even before that, I think you might also like to thank a few people. I see that you've got several such persons. So much to do, so little time.
Yes,
Doug Henwood.
We have a nice little stack of cards here. Thank you, Hugh. Nice little stack of cards of people to thank. First, John McKay of Bradley Beach, New Jersey, I think, who wants to make sure that Hugh knows he's great. Hugh is great, it says in quotation marks.
Ah. So, thank you.
No dispute here. Thank you, Joan Goodman of South Salem, New York. I hope other people find these as difficult to read as I do sometimes. Thomas Aletta of Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey. Thank you for your pledge. Also, Lionel Narciss of Elmont, New York. And apologies if I'm mangling the pronunciation of anybody's names. Milford Pruitt of Brooklyn, thank you for your pledge. Edmund Brady, I think that says, of Astoria, thank you for your very generous pledge. David Gutzman of Brooklyn, thank you for your pledge. And Julia Zoyner, also, thank you for your pledge. Thanks to all of you. And all of you who haven't yet pledged, you must do so. And time is running out on the this segment of the program, or this segment of the fundraiser. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. 212-209-2950. And This is a special joint venture of TalkBack, Hugh Hamilton, and Behind the News, me, Doug Henwood. We're desperately trying to raise the funds necessary to keep this radio station going for another few months. We live like most people do, paycheck to paycheck.
Uh-huh.
Except it's our listeners that write our paychecks. We need you more than ever. These are tough times. Economic times are tough, but the political times are tough, too.
Thank you.
WBAI is needed more than ever right now. And about a year ago, I interviewed Noam Chomsky for a fundraiser. He said at the time that this country is incomparably more civilized than it was 40 years ago. And I think one of the reasons for that is the existence of WBAI and the Pacifica Network, which have done a great deal to at least try to civilize this riotous country. And we need to keep doing that work of civilizing this riotous country. So, but that doesn't come for free. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Let's hear a few more of those, the metal striking metal and making that lovely ring. 212-209-2950. And keep our volunteers busy. We don't want got to keep the workers busy. This is America. We can't have them slacking off. We've got to keep
absolutely
so busy they can't keep up with the ringing phones. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And it's getting almost to the half hour, so we should say this is Behind the News, sort of in a hybrid a manifestation right now with TalkBack, WBAI 99.5 FM New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And my name is Doug Henwood. This is the normal slot for Behind the News, which is one of the few places on the radio dial anywhere in the United States where you can hear the economic news reported and demystified. Most of the places, other places you can turn to for economic news will mystify to the height of Everest, but not us. We try to do it the other way around, strip away all the nonsense that gets applied to it by professional obfuscators. 212-209-2950.
That's 212-209-2950. Thank you very much for these calls. Speaking about the professional obfuscators, Doug, you and I were, I was looking at the section in your book, the chapter to which you've devoted to globalization, and I was trying to make some sense of some of the definitions of globalization that you quoted before going on in turn to explain why it is that so few people seem to have an understanding of what this means, because the experts have not done a great job at all of explaining to us what it is supposed to mean. So, if you will, explain to us what globalization is all about, but in your own inimitable way, you might want to refer to some of the other explanations that are cited there.
Yeah, there's a... There's a piece in the American Prospect a couple of years ago that reported on a focus group convened by a market researcher who operates on Jungian principles with the rather Pynchonesque name G. Clothair Rapai. And he convened this group of about a dozen people in Secaucus, New Jersey, of all places, and asked them what globalization meant to them. And answers were things like, nothing's personal. No more privacy. It's all machines. The world is getting too small. There's no more mystery. They also talked about the fight for the dollar, but also their sense of atomization, alienation, powerlessness, growing gaps between rich and poor, and the deterioration in healthcare. Now, these are, I think it's an impressive list of complaints, but it's not really clear what globalization has to do with many of these things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are just ancient complaints about capitalism in general, but why it's specifically internationalizing aspects, I don't know. I think globalization is one of these words that people throw around. It's sort of, biologists call it this concept of wastebasket taxon, which is this category that you put things you don't know where else to put them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wastebasket taxon, and I think mm-hmm. that's to some degree what globalization is. It's just this kind of whenever you don't like something, you say it's globalization.
Mm-hmm.
But the professionals have done no better, or in many cases worse even than the amateurs in the focus group. The French international relations analyst Dominique Moisi define globalization as complexity, interaction, and simultaneity, which I point out could also a phrase that could also describe a crowd of tipsy customers chatting flirtatiously at a bar. Mm-hmm. The British sociologist Bob Jessop said that globalization is best used to denote a multicentric, multiscalar, multitemporal, multiform, and multicausal process, one of scales no longer in a neat hierarchy, but as coexisting and interpenetrating in a tangled and confused manner. Very much like that definition. One that is multi-causal because it results from the complex contingent interaction of many different causal processes, the complex emergent product of many different forces operating on many scales. Now, that is really very seriously clarified. And so I don't know, you know, if we got international relations analysts and sociologists trying to define it without much success, and but certainly... ordinary people convened by the focus group, who can't really define it either. I just wonder what this word means precisely to a lot of people. Capitalism has been, for the 700 or 800 years of its life, internationalizing system. Nothing. It's never been content with national boundaries. In fact, nations, you know, themselves were created out of localities, and then nations expanding into empires and trading associations and all kinds of things. So it's there's nothing particularly new about this internationalizing aspect of capitalism. The late 19th century was a period of weak states with a gold standard, which is, you know, no government at all behind a gold standard. And very, very free trade, very free capital movements, much more free than anything we know today. So there's nothing particularly novel about this, but there is a sense that, you know, I don't know, something changed around 1980 or 1990 or something, but, you know, it sort of misses the continuity in history. There's a lot of continuity in history. And I think the whole concept of globalization has been very heavily overused and probably in need of a long vacation.
We're talking with Doug Henwood, whose new book, After the New Economy, is available to you with your pledge at the $100 level. This book, After the New Economy, what I like about it most, quite frankly, is that it helps me to make sense of what Wall Street and the Wall Street Journal do a very bad job of trying to explain to me. There is an assumption when you read some of the other experts that you either A, are an expert yourself, or B, that you're simply too dumb to understand this, so don't even bother. Well, Doug Henwood, a noted economist and a business analyst himself, and of course the editor of the Left Business Observer, he makes it possible for us to be able to understand this without necessarily having to have an advanced academic degree in this field of study. Now, you spoke, Doug, about the internationalization of capitalism and the fact that this is something that has been going on for hundreds of years in the history of capitalism. There are two things that come to my mind when I think about the U.S. economy. One, its relationship to the European Union, which is still in formation and expansion, and the rise of the euro, and how that affects how any of those developments affect us here in America. And the other thing that I worry about is the outsourcing of jobs or the offshoring of jobs. So that there are so many occupations that no longer exist in this country, or at least exist only at a much smaller scale now, because these are jobs that have been are now being done in India, in Malaysia, in Hong Kong, and in Mexico and in Guatemala. Now, if you can tie all of those together, I know it's a bit of a tall order, and we don't have much time. But your thoughts?
Oh, first of all, on the euro, what I think is most interesting about it now is that this is really the first time in modern history that there's a credible rival to the dollar as an international currency. The United States has enjoyed a tremendous advantage over the last decades of really, you know, doing business, issuing the global currency. And that's meant that the United States has been able to borrow a lot of money from abroad in our own currency. When other countries borrow, they borrow in somebody else's currency and then have to earn exports in order to pay back the loan. The United States can just essentially print the money if it wants to pay off these loans. And one of the things the United States has been doing over the last 10 years in particular has been borrowing very, very heavily abroad. One of the things that kept the 90s boom going kept the recent recession from being worse than it was a tremendous inflow of foreign capital. Foreigners buying up treasury bonds, buying up corporations, buying up banks, whatever. About $2 billion every business day now coming into the United States from abroad. And that has allowed the United States to live essentially beyond its means as a country. We consume far more than we produce, which is what our trade deficit is all about. And if the United States were an ordinary country, if it were a small country like Mexico or Thailand, it would be on the verge of a standard financial crisis followed by an IMF restructuring. A lot of the indicators look very much like what they do in a country about to go into a crisis phase. But the United States is not an ordinary country, and it's been able to borrow and overconsume and not really face its day of reckoning for many, many years. The big question is how long, much longer, can the United States get away with it? And one of the things that really makes that a much livelier issue than in the past is that there is now another currency that big investors around the world can park their money in, the euro. There was a time when it was only dollar-denominated investments that were dollar-denominated markets that were big enough to absorb large amounts of capital, and now that's less and less true. The euro is a very large. There's a very large economy attached to the euro and very large financial markets. And so the foreign investors who have been, and foreign central banks and officials and governments who keep their reserves in dollars now have another option, the euro. This competition could prove interesting over the next several years, to say the least. Will the United States face some kind of financial crisis as foreign investors get tired of lending the United States money and start demanding or better returns, maybe, or looking for better returns elsewhere? There was a fascinating quote over during the Iraq War, actually, by Merrill Lynch, global strategist based in London, who said, in the 1990s, all the foreigners who poured their money in the United States thought they were financing a technological revolution. Now they're just financing a war they don't like and tax cuts for rich people. To hear that coming out of a global strategist from Merrill Lynch was kind of surprising. On the outsourcing issue, it's a really, really tough one. I had an interview on the show a couple of weeks ago with Ursula Hughes, who's just published a very fine book called The Making of a Cybertariat, published by Monthly Review Press, and I shouldn't be running somebody else's book, my own, after the New Economy, which you can get by pledging $100 and calling 212-209-2950. But it is a very fine book, Hughes, H-U-W-S, spelled in a Welsh fashion. She's done a lot of work researching the outsourcing of a lot of service industry jobs. And one of the things she's found out is that in the countries where the outsourcing happens, in India and Malaysia, a lot of these jobs are very good, very high paying. For the people who are getting these jobs, they're doing a lot better, and they pay better than the local employers do. And often these are high prestige jobs in comfortable surroundings, better, basically a good thing for a lot for the people who are getting the jobs. The problem is that it's coming at the expense of jobs in the United States, and it's very hard to take a kind of political position on this, because it's a very ugly situation of worker pitted against worker. And this is I don't think that the thing to do is just to seal ourselves off inside our national borders. That certainly wouldn't be fair to the Indian programmer or the medical transcriptionist or whatever in India. I think we need this is very abstract and very hard to turn into a political reality, but what we really need is more global solidarity among workers and among unions in order to push the general level of wages up, so workers are not in constant competition with each other. But it's not a zero sum game. Make it into a positive sum game.
But then you see, it's a lot easier when you're dealing with transferring jobs, say to Maquiladoras in Mexico, or
where they're now losing jobs to China because Chinese workers are a lot cheaper than Mexican workers.
That's right, and I see where that idea of raising the wage level, that is especially evident when you look at that kind of outsourcing. But when you're dealing with the kind of IT job, the kind of, you know, computer support tech jobs that would end up in Delhi or Bombay or wherever, even if the wages were comparable, the overheads in some of these other countries would be so much lower, though, wouldn't they?
They would be. It's there's no question about it. Everything is a lot cheaper in India. For paying a $25,000 salary to an Indian engineer, to an Indian, that's like a lot of money. But it's a fraction of what an American would get paid for the same job. It's an extremely difficult issue. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to take a position on this because it's really a matter of, like I said, worker against worker, and do Americans deserve incomes 10 times, 20 times higher than people elsewhere in the world? That's a hard argument to make. But on the other hand, you don't want to appear callous and indifferent to the American worker who's losing a job either. It's a very, very complicated problem, and I wish I had a nice soundbite answer to it. My soundbite is, I think, that we, at least in the richer countries, should think more about protecting workers and not jobs. So if a worker loses a job or can't find a job, there should be very generous income supports and, you know, jobs programs and things like that, which will really remove the sting of unemployment and make it much less a matter of pitting worker against worker than the current situation where if you lose your job, you're screwed right now.
What about things like the Nirvana type things like universal health care and so on? In Canada they pay quite a bit in taxes, and in Britain they pay very high taxes. In much of Europe, in the Scandinavian countries, but then if you get sick, you don't have to worry as much. Where do you stand on the question of taxation and providing a social safety net that is more extensive?
Well, I'm all for that, as you might imagine. I think those are very good and very important things to provide. And you never see tax rebellions developing in Canada, and you don't see tax rebellions developing in Western Europe. People are very pleased with the level of services, and they like them. Americans actually pay a fairly high level of taxes and get very little in return for it. You know, in other countries, they pay fairly high taxes but get a lot in return for it. But we're busy supporting an empire and a very expensive military and a very expensive bases all over the world. And instead, in other countries, they get universal health care and generous unemployment benefits and guaranteed jobs if they can't find work and things like that, which I think could, I would imagine that, it would, an awful lot of people would be happy to pay higher taxes if they were getting these good things in return for them. But, like I said, most Americans pay high taxes and can't figure out what they get in return for it.
Our telephone number is 212-209-2950, and we're talking with Doug Henwood, who, of course, is right here in his regular time slot. He is, of course, the host of Behind the News on Thursday afternoons. I am Hugh Hamilton, and the reason that you're hearing me in this time slot together with Doug is that he and I are doing a sort of hybrid operation here this afternoon that we began at 4 o'clock. Doug's brand new book, fresh off the presses, is titled After the New Economy, and he has also prepared as a companion commentary to go with the book an audio lecture. It's a talk, he describes it as, an audio commentary. It's a talk. It's a bit of pre-recorded punditry, to use his term, which I rather like. And you can get both the commentary and the book with your pledge of $100 to WBAI. It's a very generous offer on Doug's part, and I urge you to take advantage of it. I have my own copy of the book that I, of course, received as soon as it came off the presses. I have read it. I recommend it, and I urge you to take advantage of the offer at 212-209-2950. That's our telephone number. Our volunteers are standing by. We only have another about seven minutes or so before we have to wrap this up this afternoon, and so we need to have a flurry of telephone calls. We need to make a really fine showing here. You, of course, would normally be listening to Doug at this time. And while Doug is a very respected, very noted economist and business analyst, I know that he is probably too modest to say some of this for himself. So I'm saying it for him, that this is a reference work that you need to have. It is something of tremendous value. You will find it to be of value not only to yourself, but also to people you know, children, your college age students, your high school students, who you're trying to get interested in understanding how the economy works and what is this economy that we're talking about. Is there such a thing as a pure economy, and how does it work, and how do things relate to each other? How does fiscal policy relate to income? How does income relate to standard of living or quality of life? What about income gaps between men and women? Income gaps when race is a factor? Is discrimination a real thing in economic theory? What about this globalization everybody's talking about? Is technology a good thing or a bad thing? Or is it, as Doug Henwood has pointed out, it's supposed to be a neutral thing, technology and globalization. It is how these things are used. 212-209-2950 is the telephone number. 212-209-2950. Doug, have you done any of the book signing things, the tours?
No, that's just that hasn't started yet. Going to start in the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say, you make it sound like it's just like eating your spinach, but I hope there's some good jokes in there too.
Absolutely. There are quite a few good jokes that I saw there, but you have a very wry sense of humor. This is not, people have to read this to get it. For example, very early in the book, you say this, you refer to the new economy. And then you say, this book is an attempt to kick the thing while it's down.
Hope that it'll never get up again.
Yes, that's right. I hope that it'll never get up again. Yes, it's also really funny, the way you use the language and the observations that you make. This is why I agree with Susie Bright, who says of this book, in her review of the book, Doug Henwood is a wicked genius who makes you laugh, while pointing out the most horrific consequences of capitalism's most titillating hours. 212-209-2950 is the telephone number to call. We're running down here now on time. We have just another 5 minutes or so, five, maybe 6 minutes if we really stretch it. So we need a flurry of telephone calls from you. Join those who already have called us. And get Doug's new book, After the New Economy, together with his companion commentary, which is available to you on compact disc. Obviously, we won't be able in the remaining time to play you an additional excerpt from that, but I know that Doug's presence here this afternoon over the past 2 hours or so has enabled us to obtain quite a few additional insights into some of the issues of the day as they pertain to the new economy and its aftermath. Doug.
Yes, and the listeners always tease us by waiting very, very long to call.
Uh-huh.
They're playing with us. And I should remind them, it's not just a matter of supporting this radio station. It's our egos, too. If we don't hear those phones ringing, we feel very unappreciated.
Indeed.
Very alone in the world. And you really wouldn't have to walk around with our heads hanging down, feeling depressed demeanor. It'd be very, very bad. So if the more people who call 212-209-2950 and pledge any amount, $50 for the basic subscription package, $25 for the low income student, unemployed, and $100 will, of course, get you my book, After the New Economy, just out from the new press. About to hit the bookstores, but I think they're not. It's not fully there yet. And also the CD with the companion talk about the book. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. And we do have some people to thank. Robert Summer of my neighborhood, Upper West Side. Thank you for your pledge. Very generous pledge. Martin Gottlieb of South Orange. Thank you for your pledge. What does it say? I can't read this name. I'm very sorry. Anthony Milano of Bellport, thank you for your pledge. And Nagasur Rahman of Brooklyn, thank you too for your pledge, and thank you for all those people who are making the phones ring now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and after a little flurry of calls, they're teasing us again.
Oh, yes.
They're trying to drive us into the pit of despair by not calling 212-209-2950.
Well, you see, what it is, Doug, is that when experts like you are on, people don't want, thank you very much for these calls that are coming in now, people don't want to take a moment to go to the phone because they're afraid they might miss something. And that, of course, is a risk that we ask you to take. But you'll get it back when you get the book, 212-209-2950. We're getting the signal here from Mr. Michael G. Haskins, or audio engineer and the station's chief announcer. He's got all kinds of business to take care of. I'm Hugh Hamilton, so I'm going to shut up at this point. And, Doug, you, of course, have the last word. It's your time slot. It's your show. I want to thank you very much. I have learned a great deal, and I urge people to call, get the new book, Doug's new book, 212-209-2950, After the New Economy by Doug Henwood.
And yes, a $100 pledge will get you that and the CD with my talk, and this will not be on the web, so you're going to have to pledge. It's the only way to get that exclusive package. Thanks to all of you who did pledge, and thanks to all of you who I know will pledge very shortly. 212-209-2950. Keep the radio station going and keep our psyches from imploding in despair. 212-209-2950. That's it for me. I will be off for a couple of weeks and back, I guess, not sure exactly when, but till then, so long, and thank you, Hugh, and thanks to all the folks who called. 212-209-2950.